You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the April 2019 issue of Vanity Fair magazine, which features Beto O'Rourke on the cover. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's this month's editor's letter from Editor-in-Chief Radhika Jones, The Big Ambitions of Generation X. It's happened twice in the last few months. I'm scrolling through my Twitter feed to assess how bonkers the news is that day, regular bonkers or extra special bonkers, and I see a news graphic of generations listed in order by birth year. The silent generation, the baby boomers, millennials, and post-millennials. The segment of the population aged 38 to 53, better known as Generation X, is MIA, missing in action. Apparently, as Doc Brown once whispered in horror to Marty McFly, we've been erased from existence. The jokes write themselves. It's classic Gen X to be overlooked, and even more classic Gen X to post ironic quips. On Twitter, a platform Gen Xers invented about being totally fine with that. Whatever. Look us up, and you'll find us described as latchkey kids, letting ourselves into broken homes distractively presided over by our divorced parents, in whose selfish absence we babysat ourselves in front of music videos on MTV. In the immortal words of Lloyd Dobler of 1989's Say Anything, we didn't want to sell anything, buy anything, or process anything. Recession made us cynical. We were the late 20th century's middle child, stuck between two bigger generational cohorts and too disaffected to care. Disclosure, I am an actual middle child, but I never had a latchkey, and my parents are celebrating their 49th anniversary this year. Generational analysis is like astrology. You can't be too literal about it, or you ruin the fun. Millennials and boomers have their enormous footprints all over the news these days, from the new dynamos in Congress to the old dynamos in Congress. Come 2020, baby boomers will have held the White House for 28 years, and a bunch more of them want to make it 32. It's millennials and boomers, our prevailing narrative would have it, who are locked in an existential battle over the future of the planet, the social safety net, and our financial well-being. Anyone following events in the Capitol and in the culture might think there were no 40-somethings in the ring. I'm too Gen X to make a big deal about it, but I have been struck lately by how many of my fellow Gen Xers are busy making decisions, making change, and getting stuff done. Some of them are right here in our April issue, diverting you with wit. Hello, Maya Rudolph and Amy Poehler, who talked to Joy Press about Witchy Circles and their new movie Wine Country. Transporting you through music. Hello, Oscar winner Mark Ronson, who talks to Lisa Robinson about Miley, Gaga, and his own new creative path. And delivering cinematic excellence. Hello, Oscar winner Regina King, photographed by Mark Seliger in our star-studded Vanity Fair Oscar Party Portrait Studio. And some of them, Cory Booker, Julian Castro, Kirsten Gillibrand, are out here running for president. Generational parameters don't outweigh an individual's politics and charisma, and Gen X is the last group apt to rally around one of its own for solidarity's sake. But as Joe Hagan, 47, found in conversations with Beto O'Rourke, 46, there is a question simmering about the way to wield power in this era of disruption and transition. Generation X understands pressure. We're sandwiched not just between boomers and millennials, but between parents aging in a dysfunctional healthcare system and children inheriting a warming planet. Gen Xers are not dreamers deluded by manifest destiny, as a friend of O'Rourke's put it to Joe. Gen Xers are immune to bullshit, as Joe put it to me, a quality that seems like it might be particularly useful these days. Joe began his reporting by speaking to O'Rourke's friends and advisors, but it wasn't until he dropped by the family home in El Paso that he and Beto connected, talking about punk rock and personal history. They frequented the same bar in mid-90s Brooklyn. At that point, O'Rourke hadn't decided whether he would run, but as Joe reports, he already knew that he wanted to. The ambition to lead doesn't quite fit the slacker profile commonly associated with Gen X. Slackers grow up, though, and it wouldn't surprise me if Gen X's invisibility turns out to be our superpower.
Thank you.
Now for this month's correspondence. With an opening illustration by Peter Umansky, showing a lady lying in a meadow reading the latest copy of Vanity Fair magazine. Here's a quote overheard at the Vanity Fair Oscar party. Mark Hamill, for the third time, your car is here. The Chateau. And this comes from Nat Gunter, Charleston, South Carolina. Mark Rotzo's love letter to the Chateau Marmont is the most spot-on piece I've ever read about a place hell-bent on complicating any attempt to memorialize it. Secrets of the Chateau Marmont, Hollywood issue. I gave the Chateau the better part of my 20s as the manager of its restaurant. Everything that transpired there seemed both totally normal and sprinkled with fairy dust. Yet in my attempts to recount those tales, more than a decade later, every word seems unbelievable. Madeline Dijon writes from Santa Fe, New Mexico. As someone who called the Chateau my home away from home from 1980 until 2015, I loved your portrait of the Grande Dame of Hollywood's Sunset Boulevard. I would like to gently correct the former guest anecdote about the hotel manager's dress. Daniel never wore boots. Well, maybe when he wasn't at the Chateau, as he called it. He wore black ballet slippers and long white socks. Higher up, he was clad all in black, black ballet workout pants, and a black long-sleeved pullover. He wore stark white makeup, and his hair was dark, long, and stringy. In the mid-80s, the owners hired a woman manager, too. One day, she did not show up, nor did Daniel. Later, I was told they had decamped together to somewhere in Europe. Oh, the evolution of the Chateau Marmont. It is a magical place. And maybe one day, when she's had enough enchanting, she will shroud herself in the mist of time and disappear. Corrections. On page 130 of the December issue in The Comeback Kid by Sam Kashner, the surname of Kieran Culkin's mother was misspelled. It is Brentrup, Brentrup. On page 36 of the 2018-2019 holiday issue, in the editor's letter, the date of the last issue in which Vanity Fair published a Hall of Fame portfolio was incorrectly given. It appeared in the 2016-2017 holiday issue. On page 40 in the gift guide, the record label responsible for the Voyager LPs was misidentified. It is Ozma Records. Social. From at the Cherry Bomb. There are a lot of party venues being set up on every corner, but there is only one at Vanity Fair Oscar party. From at Real Ron Howard, at Paige Howard and I are off to the at Vanity Fair Oscar party, dad-daughter date. From at Amy Kin LA, the car pickup line outside the at Vanity Fair Oscar party is kinda unreal. There's a traffic cop with a loudspeaker, and when a black car pulls up, he announces it to everyone. He just said, Mark Hamill, for the third time, your car is here. It's like school pickup. From at Matt Bomer, thank you at Vanity Fair for an unforgettable night. From at Jessica Alba, at Vanity Fair, you sure throw a fun party. 85 years ago. And the photograph here is by Edward Steichen from February 1934. Katharine Hepburn, then on Broadway, in The Lake. Dorothy Parker, Vanity Fair editor, writer, critic, reportedly trashed the performance. Watch Katharine Hepburn run the gamut of emotions from A to B. Now for some of this month's contributors. Amy Fine Collins, Tootsie's brand new bag. His virtuosic complexity as an actor will surprise us all, says Vanity Fair special correspondent Amy Fine Collins of Santino Fontana, who will star in the Broadway adaptation of Tootsie. William Ivy Long, the king of transformations, was born to do the costumes. Her book, The International Best Dressed List, will be published this fall. Art Streiber, what a trip! Streiber's portraiture has appeared in Vanity Fair since 1994. His cinematic take on Maya Rudolph and Amy Poehler was inspired by Bob Hope and Bing Crosby's Road movies and reflects the special bond between his two subjects. They kept falling into characters, he says, forcing each other and the crew into fits of laughter. Stas Komorowski, the music man. Komorowski photographed Mark Ronson in the Musician Producers Hollywood studio. He was easygoing and charming, the photographer recalls, but also very decisive, which was great. Komorowski is working on a book about America as seen from his perspective as an Eastern European immigrant. Nick Bilton in Cold Blood. Bilton, a Vanity Fair special correspondent and the author of three books, has charted the uncanny rise and epic fall of Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos since 2016. Holmes' story encapsulates the deceit and irresponsibility of Silicon Valley, says Bilton. For once, we have an instance where justice was seemingly served. Mae Jeong, Gone Girl. Jeong, who served as a war correspondent in Afghanistan, traveled to Beijing, spoke with scores of sources, and delved deeply into Chinese culture for her story on the disappearance of megastar Fan Bingbing. I'm interested in stories of women who disappear, she says, and the empty space they leave behind. All That Jazz, sponsored by FX, premieres April 9th at 10 p.m. on FX. Sam Rockwell, Michelle Williams, Fosse, Burden. 5, 6, 7, 8. The story of illustrious choreographer Bob Fosse and Broadway dancer Gwen Verdon is the stuff of entertainment legend. The love they shared, the art they created, and the price they paid in the pursuit of greatness. 1940. The career of Robert Louis Fosse is born at the tender age of 13 when he teams up with Charles Grass to perform as the Riff Brothers in vaudeville, burlesque, and movie house amateur nights. 1953. After beginning as a choreography assistant for stage and screen and dancing small specialty roles, Gwyneth Evelyn Verdon gets her big break. Despite originally being cast as the second female lead in the Broadway musical Can-Can, she upstages the lead and earns a Tony Award for the performance. 1955. Fosse receives his first Best Choreography Tony for his work on The Pajama Game. The same year, he meets Gwen after choreographing her in Damn Yankees, a huge success that would earn each another Tony Award and come to define both of their careers. 1963. 3 years later, in 1969, the duo would collaborate on the critically acclaimed musical Sweet Charity, a production Bob would go on to direct for the silver screen, marking the first of his 5 feature films. 1975. Despite their eventual estrangement, the pair continue to work together on projects, including Chicago, in which Bob directs Gwen in the lead role of Roxy Hart. 4 years later, Fosse co-writes and directs a semi-autobiographical All That Jazz. The film would go on to win 4 Academy Awards. One of the theater's most influential choreographers and directors, the greatest Broadway dancer of all time, the singular romantic and creative partnership between Bob Fosse and Gwen Verdon changed the face of American entertainment from the Great White Way to Hollywood's silver screen. The new FX original drama, Fosse, Verdon, starring Sam Rockwell and Michelle Williams, explores this epic story of love and lust, talent and tenacity, loyalty and loss that spanned decades and left an indelible mark on the culture at large. Bob journeyed from vaudevillian performer to fledgling Broadway choreographer to lauded auteur of stage and screen. When his path crossed with beloved dancer and stage actress Gwen Verdon, the result was nothing short of revolutionary. Only Bob could create the groundbreaking musicals that allowed Gwen to showcase her true greatness, and only Gwen could realize the unique vision in Bob's head. But this prolific genius came at a massive cost. While Gwen remained the greatest interpreter of Bob's choreography, she remained a largely unrecognized collaborator, and Bob fueled his manic creativity with drugs, alcohol, and sex, often abusing his celebrity and power to feed his appetites. Bob and Gwen's 27-year relationship produced 1 daughter, iconic productions, and countless accolades, all at a cost more perilous than either of them could ever have imagined. The 8-episode limited series premieres on FX on April 9th at 10 p.m. opening act. Adria Arjona speaks with Vanity Fair's Krista Smith. Adria Arjona, 26, the Triple Frontier and Good Omens actress. I grew up on a tour bus, which was this magical place full of creativity and craziness. Opening photograph by Jordy Wood, styled by Tony Irvine. And Adria is dressed all in black. Black jeans, black leather jacket, black tank top, with a silver buckle on the black belt, and silver earrings. You grew up in a creative bilingual family. Tell me about your upbringing. All my memories are in Spanish, and it's the language I'm most comfortable with. So when it comes to acting, I still translate a lot. My dad's Guatemalan, my mom's Puerto Rican. I never lived in either of those places, but they injected the culture in me. We were based in Mexico City until I was about 12 years old. My father, Ricardo Arjona, is a musician, so I really grew up on a tour bus, which was this magical place full of creativity and craziness. My childhood reminds me of Captain Fantastic, the Viggo Mortensen movie. Why did you pursue acting over music? I can't sing for the life of me. Nobody would ever pay a penny to hear me sing. So I knew that wasn't an option. But when we moved to Miami and I started in private school, I felt a disconnect from the artistic world that I used to live in. I needed my escape. I remember my dad telling me to try acting because I needed a creative outlet. I was very shy and still kind of am, but on the first day of acting class, I was suddenly speaking louder, standing up taller, and I fell in love. What do you consider to be your big break? Being cast in True Detective, because it was the impossible back then. I had just graduated from the Lee Strasberg Acting School in New York, and I was blown away by the first season. I knew I had to be a part of the second. There were really big names up for my role, but I knew I was going to get it. Not in a cocky way. I had to fight for it, but I felt like I earned it. Now you're in Triple Frontier, a Netflix thriller with an all-star cast, including Ben Affleck, Oscar Isaac, and Pedro Pascal. I play Giovanna, who is the orchestrator of this huge heist. I'm the only woman in the film, so the guys were very protective of me. And working in front of Oscar Isaac is one of the most beautiful things I think I've done. It's powerful how he moves you. I'm like, shit, I should have gone to Juilliard. You're impressive on your own, with a roster of diverse roles coming up. There's Good Omens, the Amazon series adapted from the Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett novel, and Michael Bay's next action movie, Six Underground. I fell in love with the script for Good Omens, and my character, Anathema, I had to give her a heartbeat, and Six Underground was one of the best experiences of my life. They call it Bayhem for a reason. Michael Bay does things his own way and has an incredible vision. I never understood what the hell we were filming, but I just trusted him. What's next? I'm doing a Marvel movie, a spin-off of the Spider-Man University called Morbius. Jared Leto, Matt Smith, and me. I've had my first costume fitting and hair and makeup test, but I can't say much more about the movie than that. In the fan club, Michael Bay said, Adria is a bold new voice. She's tough, funny, and still has an innocent freshness about her. And Oscar Isaac said, as a Guatemalan actor myself, to see her knock it out of the park is thrilling. Thank you. Misery Loves Company, a Les Miserables miniseries premiering this month, is the latest adaptation of Victor Hugo's epic that's inspired musicals, telenovelas, and more by Hilary Bissis. 1862, Victor Hugo publishes Les Miserables. Jean Valjean steals a nation's hearts and bread. 1909, Thomas Edison's company produces a multi-part film adaptation of the novel. The reels, like Eponine's dignity, are believed to be lost. 1935, an adaptation starring Friedrich March is nominated for Best Picture by an academy that appreciates its zippy 108-minute runtime. 1943, decades before Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Valjean becomes a sewer-lurking comic book hero. 1973, Mexican TV adapts the story as, what else, Los Miserables. 1980, Claude Michel Schoenberg's blockbuster musical convinces theater kids it's kosher to rhyme virgin in the light with urgin in the night. 1998, Uma Thurman dies of shame as scorned Fantine in another movie adaptation. 5 years later, she'll rethink that strategy in Kill Bill. And in 2012, sacre bleu. 2019, PBS and the BBC mount a handsome new production starring Dominic West, David Oyelowo, and Lily Collins' magnificent eyebrows. Claire Landsbaum writes on books, The Hot Seat. A new deep dive into the terms of 8 former presidents is chock full of political hijinks and deja vu. In 1868, President Andrew Johnson found himself impeached and on trial before the U.S. Senate. Over the course of his term, he had essentially declared war on his own government, vetoing an outrageous 29 bills, firing officials without Senate permission, and pardoning old pals. Congress fought back. 15 vetoes were overridden, and after a nearly 3-month trial, Abe Lincoln's successor barely escaped conviction. The question of whether a president could govern while being on trial was a hot topic, writes Jared Cohen in Accidental Presidents, 8 Men Who Changed America, out this month from Simon & Schuster. Johnson clearly thought he could. Accidental Presidents, which focuses on the 8 men who assumed the office after their predecessors died, is littered with such germane lines. Recounting then-Vice President Chester Arthur's electioneering on behalf of James A. Garfield, Cohen writes that Arthur couldn't resist the urge to flaunt some of the shadier practices used to win. Other chapters flick at familiar themes, trust-busting, scandal-wrangling, and brawls that read like highbrow TMZ. William O. Butler lunged toward Thomas D. Arnold of Tennessee, choking him until his tongue protruded down to his cravat. Yes, we're polarized right now, Cohen, CEO of the tech incubator Jigsaw, and a former advisor to both Condoleezza Rice and Hillary Clinton, tells Vanity Fair. Yes, politics is tense, but history helps us realize that we're actually, probably, going to be okay. The book is also a reminder that when it came to succession, America's founders basically winged it. If you think about how much we leave to chance, the fact that only Andrew Johnson was a disaster is really quite the miracle, Cohen says. Something to keep in mind for 2020? Perhaps. Until we start thinking of our vice president as someone who can be president, I don't believe that mentality will change. In the pictures, Totes Literary, the best bags for this month's books. One by Valentino Garavani, and another by Michael Kors Collection. In these totes, for those looking to revisit the frisson et malaise of first love by way of exquisite British sentences, Normal People by Sally Rooney, published by Hogarth. For Francophiles and Palestinian history junkies, in the mood for epic romance, The Parisian by Isabella Hamad, published by Grove Atlantic. For a psychedelic trip back to the 60s, down to Mexico and into the early world of LSD, Outside Looking In by T.C. Boyle, published by Echo. Thank you. a royal welcome, a novelist who designs jewelry, all that and more in the next installment of Vanity Fair magazine. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.